It's Wednesday, June 26, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Some dates are long remembered in United States constitutional history. Today, June 26, 2013, is almost certain to be one of those days. Today is the last day of the Supreme Court term of the year 2012-2013, and today, that court, the nation's highest court, is going to hand down decisions in two cases related to same-sex marriage. The cases involve, in the first place, California's Proposition 8, a challenge to the constitutionality of that action undertaken by the voters of California just a few years ago. The second is a challenge to the Constitution of DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, signed into law by President Bill Clinton after being passed overwhelmingly by Congress in 1996. Both cases are destined to change the way America views not only the Constitution, but the institution of marriage. In both of these cases, the Supreme Court faces the possibility of moving not just in one or two directions, but several, perhaps three, to put it in the simplest form imaginable. In both cases, the court could rule expansively, just like it did in 1973 in the case of Roe v. Wade when the issue was abortion. It could rule that coast to coast, in every state, there is a constitutional right for same-sex couples to marry. That would be the constitutional equivalent of what happened in 1973 when Roe was handed down. On the other hand, there is a very narrow opportunity for the court. The court could rule in the case of Proposition 8 that no one has standing. It could rule the same in the DOMA challenge. If the court decides that no party has legal standing to challenge lower court decisions when it relates to both DOMA and Proposition 8, it could do effectively what it did with the decision in affirmative action earlier this week, decide effectively not to decide. That would then leave those lower court decisions in place, which would mean that DOMA is struck down as unconstitutional and that Proposition 8 would be as well. But the effect in that case would be limited to the state of California. The middle ground on both of these issues is something that is between an expansive decision and a very narrow ruling. And most constitutional experts believe that the court is most likely to rule somewhere in between. In Proposition 8, that could mean a ruling that the constitutional challenge to Proposition 8 would come down to the fact that a state that had at any point had civil unions or same-sex marriage and later denied the right to marriage to same-sex couples, that would be ruled unconstitutional. That would affect seven states, including California, but not the other 43 states in the union. When it comes to DOMA, the middle ground would be to strike down certain provisions of the law while allowing other provisions to stand. But that would almost certainly lead to both legal and political chaos. Today will be long remembered because, regardless of how the court rules in any of these three directions or in any that the court might itself invent, it will change the course of American law. It will change the way Americans understand their Constitution. And inevitably, and far more importantly, it will change the way America looks at marriage. As we shall see over the next several hours and days, the ramifications and implications of the court's rulings are likely to be debated, and it will take some time for us to understand exactly what the justices have ruled. But in any event, we need to understand as Christians that the church is in the first place obligated to know what marriage is. The church, regardless of the culture, has to know that marriage, as Jesus said in Matthew chapter 19, from the beginning was God's intention that a man and a woman should be united in the covenant of marriage. We need to understand that even as the culture around us has been sinking progressively into a deeper and deeper confusion over the issues of sexuality and marriage, the church has to be anchored to a deeper and deeper knowledge of what is revealed in God's Word and why the institution of marriage is not merely central and essential to human civilization, but is an institution that reveals the glory of God in creation and God's gift to humanity of an institution that would lead to human flourishing. Where marriage is honored, human flourishing will increase. Where marriage is dishonored, by any means, in any direction, for any cause, human flourishing is hampered. Along with the rest of America, we'll be watching today to see how the court rules, and then all of us, Christians especially, will have some hard thinking to do about what that means not only for the country, but for us. America has been from the very beginning a land of political theater, and yesterday was a day rich with that kind of theater. Last night in Massachusetts, Representative Edward J. Markey, a Democrat who has been in Congress for almost 40 years, claimed victory in the special election called in that state to replace former Senator John Kerry, now Secretary of State John Kerry. His opponent in the case was Gabriel Gomez, a Republican who has never served in elective office, a former Navy SEAL. This was one of those elections that draws our attention to the fact that as things change, they evidently don't change much. One of the things we've been watching together in terms of the changing American political landscape is what many have called the Big Sort, where Americans are sorting themselves out into voting districts, that is, congressional districts, and in states that are now overwhelmingly, if you look at the electoral map, either red or blue. In other words, the red states, colored Republican and therefore conservative, are getting redder. And the blue states, colored for the Democrats and getting more liberal, are certainly moving even further in that direction. The evidence of that comes when you look at the special election in Massachusetts yesterday. First of all, Americans say they want new faces in politics, and then they elect a man who's been in Congress for almost four decades. Americans say they want someone who can work in a bipartisan manner, but Edward J. Markey is a very partisan Democrat. This is to be expected, as Catherine Seeley reports for the New York Times, as she writes, Mr. Markey's biggest advantage was that his views were in line with those of most voters in deep blue Massachusetts. With a much bigger war chest, which he used to flood the airwaves with ads, he campaigned consistently on his support for abortion rights and a ban on assault weapons, and reminded voters constantly that his opponent, Mr. Gomez, opposed both. End quote. Claiming victory last night in Boston, Mr. Markey said, quote, like you, I'm tired of gridlock. He said, but I will never compromise on our principles. He said he would lead what he called a green revolution and put steel workers and iron workers to work in a new economy. You have to wonder if anyone was listening, because those two things appear to be directly in contradiction. How in the world you can pledge to move to a green revolution in terms of ecology and then pledge, almost in the same breath, to put steel workers and iron workers back to work? You just have to wonder if the people in the room understood the contradiction. But then again, Americans evidently are ready to embrace contradictions. They say they want new, and they vote for old. They say they want a centrist, and they vote for a partisan. Last night in Massachusetts, we found out at least one thing, what the people of Massachusetts are looking for in a United States senator. In terms of the other great arena of political theater in America yesterday, it was the chamber of the state senate in the state of Texas. There, one state senator, Wendy Davis, launched a filibuster to prevent a bill restricting abortions from reaching the floor of the Senate. After 10 hours of filibustering, her filibuster failed when Secretary of State David Dewhurst claimed that she had failed in her filibuster because she had wandered off topic not once but twice, and she had received aid from a fellow senator. That set off a chaos of parliamentary maneuvering, challenges, and politics that the state senate in Texas probably has not seen for a very long time. As of early this morning, the Senate chamber, by live video feed, was still in consternation, with Democrats and Republicans, pro-lifers and pro-abortion advocates going at it tooth and claw in the Texas Senate. Just remember that over the weekend, demonstrators had entered the Texas state capitol, staying until 2 a.m. on Sunday morning, when the House of Representatives passed this bill. The Senate has previously passed it in Texas, but a reconciliation version has to go back to the Texas Senate for final approval. Senator Davis is doing her very best to keep that from happening, but it appears as of early this morning that she has failed. We will soon know exactly what took place in Texas, because the special session has to conclude its work by today. As we discussed yesterday on the briefing, this law, if passed and signed into law by Governor Rick Perry, he has said he would sign the measure. He has already advocated for it. It would indeed bring significant restrictions on abortion in the state of Texas. The CBS News AP story out on the story late last night says, if signed into law, the measures would close almost every abortion clinic in Texas, a state 773 miles wide and 790 miles long with 26 million people. Recall that, as we discussed, this particular bill would call for abortion clinics meeting many of the medical and technological requirements that are held for hospitals, and would require doctors performing abortions to have attending physician rights at a local hospital. One would think that if you are an advocate for women's health, you would be an advocate for these restrictions. But when you consider the monomaniacal support for abortion that now marks the pro-choice and pro-abortion movement in America, you see it in the filibuster last night in the Texas Senate. Speaking yesterday at Georgetown University in Washington, President Obama finally delivered the speech on climate change his administration had been promising for some time, and he set off a tidal wave of controversy. As the Huffington Post reports, President Obama's strategy in his second term rests on three pillars: cutting carbon pollution in America, preparing the United States for the impacts of climate change, and leading international efforts to cut global emissions. Among the top billed items on the president's agenda are imposing the first carbon limits on existing power plants and requiring all federal projects to be able to withstand the heightened storms and sea level rise associated with climate change. The president spoke of climate change. He said, "Now we know that no single weather event is solely caused by climate change. Droughts and fires and floods that go back to ancient times." He went on to say, however, "But we also know that in a world that's warmer than it used to be, all weather events are affected by a warming planet." The president also went on to say, "This plan, that is his plan, builds on progress that we've already made. Last year I took office, the year that I took office, my administration pledged to reduce America's greenhouse gas emissions by about 17% from their 2005 levels by the end of this decade. And we rolled up our sleeves and we got to work. We doubled the electricity we generated from the wind and the sun. We doubled the mileage our cars will get on a gallon of gas by the middle of the next decade," end quote. That statement was followed by applause, but you need to understand the unreality of a president speaking to these issues, whether speaking for or against climate change, or for that matter, whether the president is a Republican or a Democrat. In this case, what the president claimed, and I repeat the sentence, is, quote, "We doubled the mileage our cars will get on a gallon of gas by the middle of the next decade," end quote. What that actually means in politics is you doubled the estimate of the goal you're setting for the future that has never been met in the past. It is a form of institutionalized political hypocrisy that is found in almost every piece of major legislation. The president spoke of the urgency behind his address. He said the question is not whether we need to act. The overwhelming judgment of science, of chemistry and physics and millions of measurements has all that put to rest. 97% of scientists, including, by the way, some who originally disputed the idea, have now put that to rest. They've acknowledged the planet is warming and human activity is contributing to it. He then went on to say to his younger audience at Georgetown University, "I refuse to condemn your generation and future generations to a planet that's beyond fixing. And that's why today I'm announcing a new National Climate Action Plan, and I'm here to enlist your generation's help in keeping the United States of America a leader, a global leader, in the fight against climate change," end quote. Now, recall that back in 2008, when President Obama was first elected as president, he declared that his election would mean that the oceans will no longer rise. An amazing statement made by a president who is known for some hubristic expressions. But now he's saying that climate change is going to be a major priority of his administration. Interestingly, even the Washington Post and the New York Times, two very liberal newspapers that are fully in support of calls for addressing climate change, indeed they were putting pressure on the administration and on the president to address the issue, both the Washington Post and the New York Times have published recent articles on the fact that the Obama administration is dealing with very confusing data here and is making these projections based upon data that many people recognize is largely drawn from the air. Matthew Wald, writing for the New York Times, wrote this: "The Obama administration is making a second attempt to systematically account for the dollar damage from greenhouse gas pollution, even with no consensus on how to forestall global warming or whether to do so." Now, Wald explains the new effort is an update to an estimate for the awkwardly named social cost of carbon. Now, I inject here that this is a major part of what the president was talking about yesterday at Georgetown University. His administration, through the bureaucracy and through even some of the executive orders he announced yesterday, wants to use the regulatory mechanisms of government to cost in the cost of climate change in terms of retail products such as we shall see, microwave ovens. Wald writes, "When the government totes up costs and benefits for a variety of proposed regulations, the so-called social cost of carbon is plugged into the calculation to decide how to write the regulation." He then writes, "The new price, used for the first time last month in establishing a standard for energy efficiency in new microwave ovens, is 50% to 100% higher per ton than the one developed in 2010. He then writes, "But precision is hard to come by. Some of these changes appear to be likely but hard to calibrate, like the extent of sea level rise. Others are less certain and thus stated as probabilities, like the increase in the number of Katrina-level hurricanes or sustained droughts or changes that radically cut crop yields. Others are simply hard to put a dollar figure on, such as the extinction of a species." Wald then writes, "Another difficulty is how to put a value today on a price that will be paid by future generations, which is why the cost is stated in a range." He then quotes Nathaniel Keohane, a former special assistant to President Obama, who said, quote, "There are multiple sources of uncertainty, but," he said, "the calculation is certainly a good idea." Now, before moving on, let's recognize exactly what we've been told here. Not on a website just published somewhere, but in the influential pages of the New York Times. Matthew Wald cites Matthew Keohane, a former special assistant to President Obama, who likes what the administration has done, as saying, quote, there are multiple sources of uncertainty. But he then says, even though we aren't certain at all about what we're dealing with here, it's still a good idea. Similarly, in the Washington Post, Brad Plummer reports, the Obama administration is effectively saying that climate change will be more damaging than previously estimated, in part because of the impacts of future sea level rise. And that means U.S. government agencies could, in theory, justify even stricter regulations to curb greenhouse gas emissions. Uncertainty enters the scene again when Brad Plummer writes, it's always difficult to settle a precise number for the amount of damage a given ton of carbon dioxide causes. There's a fair bit of uncertainty about future climate costs. To get a sense for all the variables involved, in its 2013 memo, the federal government even recalculated how space heating bills could be affected by higher temperatures. End quote. Some are certainly claiming that the administration is using a figure that's too high, but as is reported in the Washington Post, Frank Ackerman of Tufts University, Laurie Johnson of the National Resources Defense Council are saying that the White House is using figures that are too low, indeed claiming that the social cost of carbon should be twice as high or 12 times as high or 45 times as high. In one of the great reportorial understatements of recent years, the reporter for the Washington Post simply says, the assumptions used can matter a lot. Of course they can, and these are assumptions. If, indeed, the experts in the field say that it may be twice too high, or it might actually be half too low, or it needs to be increased by 12 times, or it's actually 45 times as high, and when the New York Times and the Washington Post are both saying, quoting even officials within the administration, these are calculations that include, quote, multiple sources of uncertainty, end quote, one thing you can be certain of, someone is building a political reputation on defending something that can't even be calculated. Christians of goodwill and operating out of a consistent Christian worldview can disagree and even admit to a level of humble confusion about how actually to understand climate change, global warming, and balancing the biblical teachings about the human dominion over nature and the responsibility of careful ecological stewardship. Christians can also disagree about something as technical as what exactly should be added to the cost of a microwave oven or factored into its technical specifications in order to save energy. Saving energy is almost by any measure a good thing. But the technology and cost involved in saving that energy is a cost that has to be paid, and that means not paying for something else. Weighing and balancing all of these things is a political art. A political art that isn't made more accurate by leaning into the kind of uncertainty that is behind the calculations announced yesterday. Once again, I remind you that today is a major day in American constitutional history. Tomorrow on The Briefing, we'll have a special edition to review these two Supreme Court decisions in detail. In the meantime, let's remind ourselves of the Christian responsibility as ordered in Scripture to pray for those in authority over us. Those prayers ought to be directed right now to the nine justices of the United States Supreme Court. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmoeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.